We have got our prophecy series that is continuing on. And the main thing, these are the topics we've gone over already, but the main thing that I wanted to mention again as we head into tonight's study especially is just the approach that we take for interpretation, and that being the literal approach. And that's important tonight as we look at this topic of world government in the last days. As we're going to be looking at passages that talk about the governments of the world, we're going to see how they were initially spoken and initially taken and also fulfilled in a literal manner. So as we look at what they have to say concerning the last days, it just lays the foundation of why we should take that in a literal manner as well as we're looking towards the future. So again, let's just keep that at the forefront of our mind as we take a look at this topic. We talked of the tribulation last week and talked about the fact that it begins with the confirming of a seven-year covenant, which is the fulfillment of the 70th week of Daniel. And again, the centerpiece here are the people of Daniel, the Jewish people, and also the city of Jerusalem. So this is just central when it comes to prophecy, the nation of Israel, the Middle East. It's not that it excludes by any means the rest of the world. It does not. But it's just important to remember that this is the focal point of so much of what we have within the Bible. God chose for his reasons Abraham and his descendants to reveal himself to, and really ultimately to show himself through to the rest of the world. And he brought his son into the world as a Jewish man, according to his humanity, to save the world, to save us from our sin. And so this is a sovereign choice that God made. And as we look at the scriptures, the history of the nation of Israel, and as we look at the wrap-up of the ages, I mean, it is centered there in the Middle East. Again, it doesn't by any means exclude the rest of the world, because the entire world is going to be affected. And all of humanity is affected by the need for a savior. But this is where the roots are. This is the root of the tree. And we just want to keep that in focus as we're looking at prophecy so that we can accurately interpret what is going on. So we are talking about, really, when you dig down into it, we're talking about the rise of the Antichrist, this leader of the last days form of human government. And what we're going to be focusing on specifically is the 10-nation confederacy, the reuniting of the ancient Roman Empire. And I want to look at what the Bible has to say concerning that. And for me, it's been an interesting topic. It's got a lot of threads throughout the scriptures. And so we're going to look at the main passages tonight. And I just want to be able to pull them together and track with what the Bible has to say on those lines. And that will help with the base as we move forward on what the Antichrist is doing. That sounds like such an evil term. And in reality, it kind of is. He is an evil man. But it's a term that simply means opposed to Christ or in place of Christ. And it's used by the Apostle John. He goes by, or he's spoken of in many different ways with many different titles. But it's the Apostle John that gives us the title of the Antichrist for this one who is going to rule over this 10-nation confederacy and ultimately seek to, and to a large extent, rule over the world. So the topic, a one-world government, human government in its last form, as we look at this tonight. Let's go to Daniel 2, if you haven't turned there already. And this is the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar has, and Daniel gives the interpretation of the dream, and this is foundational to, again, human government, and more importantly, the end of that and the beginning of the kingdom of God on earth. So let's look at Daniel chapter 2, and we're going to begin from verse 31, where it says, Daniel interpreting the king's dream here, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image, this great image whose splendor was excellent stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and broke them in pieces. then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king. So the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, which when you think about it, for Daniel to be able to nail that, must have really impressed King Nebuchadnezzar to be able to tell him what his dream was before he even gave him the interpretation. But it was of this big metallic image that was made of different metals, gold, silver, bronze, iron, and then clay. And then this image was struck by a stone that was cut without hands. And it's important in our passage to see that this image was struck on the feet. It was struck on the feet, and that destroyed, it pulverized the entire image. And then the image, it was blown away. There was nothing left at all of the image. And then the stone grew into a great mountain that filled the entire earth. Now, what Nebuchadnezzar has seen is an image that represents the kingdoms of the world, beginning with his kingdom in his day. And so that metallic image represents man's rule upon the earth. And the reason we know that is because Daniel's going to give us the interpretation. That's the nice thing about a lot of what we're going to talk of tonight. It's not just, you know, commentators or me going, well, this is what it represents with really no reasoning behind it. It's given for us in the passage. And that's what's great about this as we dig in, is we see that it represents the governments that would rule upon the earth, starting from Nebuchadnezzar's day in this particular dream and moving forward. And the stone represents the coming of Jesus Christ. And he comes, and think about it, when he comes at his second coming, he's putting an end to the battle of Armageddon, and he's setting up his kingdom. So he's putting an end to man's rule upon the earth. And, you know, man's rule has really not been good from the get-go. It's been filled with fallen man's ideas. And so you have corruption and injustice and so forth. And so he comes, and that's where it's significant, I think, to notice that this stone hits the image on the feet. It doesn't hit the image in the head or in the stomach. It hits the image on the feet, because these metals on this image are representing successive kingdoms that would rule on the earth. So it starts in this image with ancient Babylon, and it moves forward from there until you get to the feet that are made up of partly iron and partly clay, which are representing the kingdom, the last form of human government that will be upon the earth. And so that gives it logic as he comes and he destroys the last days world empire, and that puts an end to man's rule upon the earth. And that's the significance of the whole image being blown away, and there's no trace left of man ruling upon the earth. It's done because Jesus has come, and now this rock in the dream has grown into a great mountain now that has filled the whole earth. And the mountain is an idiom, a symbol, a figure of a government. And in this case, it's God's government on the earth. And that's speaking of the kingdom age, the millennial reign of Christ. Does that make sense? So that's giving you the interpretation that Daniel's going to give Nebuchadnezzar right here. And again, this is laying the foundation for what's yet to come in the last days. So this is the dream, verse 36. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. Verse 37, you, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So we've got the interpretation of the gold head right there. Daniel's saying to Nebuchadnezzar, that's you. The gold head represents you, or I think not just him, but he and his kingdom. Why do I think that? Because of the next verse. It says in verse 39, but after you shall arise another kingdom. And then keep going. Inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. So do you see that? Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold, verse 39, but after you shall arise another kingdom that would be the chest and arms of silver, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And then verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron. And remember, the next metal were the legs of iron that were on the image. So you can see, I mean, it's really clear, isn't it, that these metals are representing kingdoms that would come and successive. You are the head of gold, but then there's going to be another kingdom, and then a third kingdom of bronze. And then verse 40, the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Now, how do we know what these other metals represent? I mean, we'll say that, obviously, like I said here, the gold represents Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. Well, what was the next kingdom that came? We look to history, first of all, is one way to do it. The Medo-Persians conquered the Babylonians. So we would say the chest and arms of silver represent the Medo-Persian Empire. And then after Medo-Persia came Greece. And so we would say the belly and thighs of bronze would represent the Greek Empire. And after that would come the Roman Empire. So you have the two legs. And some see that as east and west of Rome as they continued on in their distinct areas as history went on. Okay, so we can look at history and we can say that all we've been given is Babylon. Isn't that right? We've only been given Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold, and then we are filling in the rest. But as we're going to see, we've got more than just history that will help us fill that in, because in chapter 8, Medo-Persia and Greece are named by name, which again to me is fascinating from a prophetic standpoint in Daniel's day. Okay, so this isn't like really grasping at straws here. It's really pretty clear what this is representing. However, we've made it, let's say, to Rome of the first century, but we've got this image being destroyed by the second coming of Jesus. We've got to factor that in, don't we? Because we can't just go, this image represents everything up to Rome of the first century, and then it's all history, it's done with, there's nothing prophetic, because Jesus hasn't returned and set up his kingdom that fills the entire earth and man's rule is done, has it? So that is something that is still yet future, and that's what makes us think that the feet of iron mingled with clay is the last form of human government upon the earth, and that it's coming out of the legs of iron, and the feet are made of iron and clay. This is one part of the reason why commentators feel that this is a revival of the ancient Roman Empire, that this is a government that is going to rise at least geographically from that area in that part of the world, or the European common market. There's been, you know, a big thought concerning that. Can you imagine? Because we're going to talk, I'm getting ahead of myself, but we're going to talk about, again, this 10-nation confederacy. Can you imagine when the European common market began to grow, and it's like, oh, this could be it. This could be the 10. And as it crept up to however many and got to 10, but then past 10, and now I think it's to 28 or something like that, it kind of maybe lost a little bit of its steam as far as that being the exact fulfillment. A lot of people think it's the seedlings of it right now, that, and we'll talk about this more as we go, but think of that as we make our way to this. So anyway, again, he says in verse 41, whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. We're just now introduced to the toes. We just saw the feet before, iron and clay, but now he mentions toes. Now, most people have five toes on each foot, or a total of 10 toes, and that becomes a neat parallel when we get to the vision that Daniel has in his dream, Daniel chapter 7, that has the ferocious beast with the 10 horns. It seems to be a parallel, the 10 horns, and here the 10 toes. So the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, They will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Now, what is that talking about? Well, let's think about it for one moment. If you have a 10-nation confederacy, if you've got the last human government in this particular form where you have 10 nations together, let's say something like what's happening in the European community, you're going to have nations that are big and they have a lot to bring to the table, and you're going to have nations that are small and they don't really have a whole lot. You're going to have nations that are strong and you're going to have nations that are weak. You're going to have differing cultures that make up this final form of human government. You're going to have different political systems. You're going to have different, maybe even religious faiths that are in this. And so the lack of unity is how some see this. There's strength, but there's also weakness within it. And because of that, it's going to crumble because of the lack of unity that is there. In verse 44, it says, "And in the days of these kings." Now, what kings is he talking about? Is he talking about the successive empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome? Or is he talking about the 10 toes that are on the feet? Are you with me on that? The iron mingled with clay. And the reason I bring that up is because we're going to find in Daniel 7, the 10 horns are specifically identified for us in Daniel 7 as 10 kings. And so, as it says in verse 44, in the days of these kings, I think it's referring to the final form of human government. In other words, the last final world empire. So in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. That's the second coming of Jesus. That's the destroying that 10-nation confederacy, the final form of human government, and then the setting up of his kingdom on the earth. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Verse 45, inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. And so I believe what we have here is this metallic image is representing the world governments that will come on the scene, beginning here in Nebuchadnezzar's day with Babylon, and then Medo-Persia, and then Greece, and then Rome, and then this final form of human government. Some refer to it as a revived Roman Empire. Some refer to it as Rome II. It's the final government that's going to be enforced when Jesus returns. And it's going to be headed up and led by this man known to us by the Apostle John as the Antichrist. Okay, so this is the framework that we have in Daniel chapter 2 here. Let's go ahead and turn over to Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, it says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. The four winds, does that remind you of Daniel or Revelation 7? Where the four angels were holding back the four winds until the 144,000 were sealed. And what were the angels? What was being held back? The judgment, the destructive force that was going to come upon the earth until those 144,000 were protected, were sealed to be protected. And so here you have the four winds, or you could look at it as you've got destructive forces, trouble, that is stirring up the great sea. And then verse 3, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, verse 5, a second like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, many feel that in this vision, Daniel is seeing basically the same thing that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream, only he's got beasts that are representing the kingdoms of the world. So you've got the lion that is representing Babylon, the bear, Medo-Persia, the leopard, Greece, and then this ferocious beast that's representing Rome, but not just Rome of the first century. Rome that would be a revived Rome of the last days as well. And you go, well, how do you get that? Well, the reason you have to come to that conclusion is, again, you have this coming to an end with the second coming of Jesus. And that hasn't happened yet. Does that make sense? And so it has to be not only Rome of the first century, but it's got to be the last final form of human government when Jesus comes at Armageddon and puts an end to the Antichrist and his rule upon the earth and sets up his kingdom. That's one of the main reasons why. Why Rome? We'll talk about that a little bit more in just a second. But you have, in this case, some details with the 10 horns. The 10 horns come up, and then a little horn, it's kind of interesting, it's not a big notable horn, but a little horn coming up and uprooting 3 of the 10 as this little one comes up. And that is a reference to this last day's world leader, the Antichrist. Now, as I mentioned, the most popular, and this is the most popular interpretation, and that is that these are corresponding to the vision in Daniel chapter 2 or Nebuchadnezzar's dream. So Babylon is represented by the gold head and the lion, Medo-Persia by the silver chest and arms and the bear, Greece by the belly and thigh of bronze and the leopard, and Rome by the iron legs and then the iron feet mingled with clay, and also this ferocious beast with the 10 horns. Now, in Daniel chapter 8, I've mentioned to this point, I mean, we've got all of these nations up here, but the only one we've been given is Babylon. That's the only one that's been mentioned. We're just filling in all the rest from the nations that came after Babylon. But Babylon was the only one given. Nebuchadnezzar, you are that head of gold, and we're just filling in the rest. But here in Daniel chapter 8, it's another vision that Daniel has, the vision of the ram and the goat. And this is interpreted for us, and again, it's just amazing because it's the kingdoms that will follow Babylon. So if you look just, and we'll just shoot right to the interpretation, but if you look at Daniel 8, verse 20, it says, the ram which you saw having the 2 horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. And that's a reference to Alexander the Great. And again, from a prophetic standpoint, it's just amazing that Daniel, I mean, we've got this right here in the book of Daniel. So here we've got the next 2 kingdoms spoken for us here that just corroborates historically what we're looking at. So with Medo-Persia, they're the chest and arms of silver of Daniel 2, they're the bear of Daniel 7, and they're the ram of Daniel 8. And Greece is the belly and thighs of bronze of Daniel 2, the leopard of Daniel 7, and the goat of Daniel 8. So main thing, these beasts are representing those kingdoms. And you'll say, well, how are you getting that out of Daniel 7? I mean, all I'm seeing is a lion, a bear, and a leopard. That's a good question that you have. If you move to verse 23 of Daniel 7, and again, this is the beauty of it, The identification is given for us in the interpretation. Daniel 7:23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. So this is what Daniel wanted to know. He wanted to know what did these animals represent, but specifically, I want to know about the fourth one, because the fourth one looked really bad, really ferocious, and you've got these 10 horns, and then you've got this little horn, and he wanted to know about the little horn as well. And as you look at verse 24, and we're gonna come up to this, but as you look at verse 24, that's identified as well. It says the 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. And that's referring to the little horn that's coming out. And when it's horn, it's animal horn, like the strength of an animal in its horns, not a trumpet or something like that, but the horns on an animal. So it's beautiful. We get the identification of what the beasts are representing and also the horns that are upon the beast. We see they're representing kingdoms, and we're filling in historically what kingdoms those would be, as well as what we have in Daniel 2 and Daniel 8. So Let's read on from there, because we left off in verse 8, where you have this little horn coming and subduing three on this ferocious beast that has 10 horns. Verse 9 says, I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated. The books were open. Who do you think the Ancient of Days is? Doesn't sound like the guy next door, does it? The Ancient of Days, it's clearly God. And specifically, I believe it's God the Father. And we'll see that in the next couple of verses, why that is. But notice, so Daniel is watching this. He sees these kingdoms, as was interpreted for us. He sees these kingdoms, and then he said, I watched until thrones were put in place. Then verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So I watched until this final beast was destroyed. And I'll just bring up to us right here. When we get to Revelation 19, the second coming of Jesus, the beast, the Antichrist, is thrown alive into the lake of fire. This corresponds directly with that. And the interesting thing about that is when we get to Revelation 20, 1,000 years have passed, and the beast, the Antichrist, is still in the lake of fire. He hasn't been annihilated. He hasn't dissolved into nothing and doesn't exist anymore. He's still there. And it does teach an everlasting torment in the lake of fire. And so this would correspond with that. Verse 12 says, as for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season at a time. So that's the other kingdoms. They had their dominion taken away, but their lives were prolonged. Now, these are talking about kingdoms. So some see it as maybe the culture of their kingdom continued on even after they were overtaken. A great example of that is Greeks' culture being absorbed into the Roman culture as they came to power. So verse 13, as we continue on, as Daniel's watching this, he said, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Now, who do you think the Son of Man is here? You would correctly so, and not just because we think of that, but we see him actually referring back to this in the Gospel of Matthew when he's before the high priest. And he's saying, you're going to see the Son of Man coming. And the high priest, you remember, tore his robes because he saw it as blasphemous, because this is a messianic passage. It's talking about the coming of the Savior, the coming of the Messiah. Revelation 1:7, behold, he comes with clouds and every eye will see him. It's like it's predicted here. Here we see him coming, and isn't this neat? He's coming to the Ancient of Days. He's coming to the one who's seated upon the throne, and he's receiving a kingdom that will never end. Isn't it interesting in relation to Revelation 5, where we have a vision of the throne room of God, and there's one seated upon the throne with a seven-sealed scroll in his hand. Nobody's found worthy in heaven, on earth, or under the earth to take it and open it except the Lamb who has prevailed, came to the one who is seated on the throne. Isn't that, an interesting connection that we have there, speaking of the same thing? What is it? It's the end of man's rule upon the earth and the beginning of the kingdom of God on earth. We go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, where man disobeyed God, and we've been living in a world like that ever since. And this is the end that we're looking at, the wrap up of the ages. The 10-nation confederacy is simply the final form of human government that's going to be on the earth. And that's what it's showing us here with this. So that's the vision, the dream that Daniel has. Let's read on as we see the interpretation. Verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit. And by the way, we're just kind of glossing over the top of this. We're not going into the detail on the beast. If you're interested in that, because a lot of details go along with Babylon and Medo-Persia, the bear with the teeth in its mouth and so forth, on our website, in our teachings on Daniel, you can get more specifics on that. But I just want to get this idea of the 10-nation world government. Verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Verse 17, those great beasts, which are four kings, which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Now, he's talking about four kings. I have a marginal note that says representing their kingdoms. Now, if you're a king, you're most likely going to have a kingdom. So they're referred to as kings, but as we see further on down, as we already saw in verse 23, it's also talking about their kingdoms. And it says here, though, the outcome of it is the saints of the Most High are going to receive the kingdom. Now, don't answer too quickly, but who are the saints? We're going to read about the saints here in chapter 7. And as a New Testament Christian, we're really quick to jump to, well, the saints are the church. Because after all, doesn't Paul address the church, the believers in the church, as saints? And yes, he does. The word saint means simply one who is set apart. And as a Christian, you have been set apart. You're no longer operating under the morality of this world, but your God is the God of heaven and earth. So you're set apart for God's glory, and that's true. But there was also an entire nation that was set apart, that God would work through, that God chose in the beginning, and that was the nation of Israel. And so as we go through the Bible again, we want to interpret accordingly. So when it comes to the saints possessing the kingdom and inheriting it, I mean, we could easily see it really in both fashions. We can see it as the nation of Israel, because God's not done with the nation of Israel yet. They're going to come to know Christ in the days of the tribulation. And when Jesus returns, the land that was promised to Abraham and his descendants, I mean, is going to be realized at that time. And so you've got in Ezekiel the division of the land during the millennium to the 12 tribes of Israel. So they will possess the kingdom. And yet we read about the church as well, coming back and ruling and reigning with Christ during that time. We read about those martyred during the tribulation, that they will be ruling as well. We read about those that are living and become believers during the tribulation, that they will populate the millennium as human beings during that time. So there's different entities that we have. And you have to remember that a saint is simply one that has been set apart. In the Old Testament, we clearly see it as Israel. In the New Testament, we clearly see it as the church. As we interpret this passage And we see not just that the saints are going to receive the kingdom, but that they're also going to be overwhelmed by the Antichrist. We have to recognize that interpretation becomes important, because if you just say saints are the church, then you clearly have a scriptural foundation for the church going through the tribulation here in this passage. So that's part of interpretation is our approach to it in taking the context of it. So we need to keep that in mind. So we read on. Verse 19, then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet, and the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which 3 fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So the Antichrist, the little horn, he is going to prevail over the saints until a certain period of time. And that's when Jesus returns, the wrap-up of the ages, and the kingdom is given to him. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all of the kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue 3 kings. So a scenario you can put in place, and we'll see this as we make our way through this, you've got 10 kings over kingdoms that have united together, and you have this little one, not a big notable one, but this little one who comes up, who's able to subdue 3 as he comes to take power and to take control. I think it's interesting that it gives us, I think, some insight. He's a little horn. He's not a big notable horn. And I don't know if that speaks of the way he comes into power, that he doesn't come as real strong and powerful in a military sense, but maybe he comes in as a man of peace. Maybe he comes in as a very charismatic person and is able to come in and really exercise that strength. Notice, though, verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. So the pompous words we see are directed against God. Shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Now, the idea with this, he's going to intend to change times and law. The New Living Translation translates that he will try to change their sacred festivals and laws. Wow, that sounds a lot like in the middle of the 70th week, he's going to put an end to sacrifice and offering, doesn't it? Daniel 9:27. It sounds a lot like 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where he's going to go into the holy place and proclaim himself to be God. Not going to have your sacrificial system anymore in Israel, but he's going to come in with the abomination of desolation. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Wow, now we're connected to the book of Revelation right here, aren't we? Because we have the same phrase in Revelation chapter 12, and we interpret that as 3.5 years. And the reason that we do that is because it's laid alongside 42 months. It's laid alongside 1,260 days. It's the latter half or the former half. It's the half of the 70th week of Daniel. And so a time, times, and half a time is interpreted as a time being 1 year. So you have a time singular, and then you have times plural, 2 more, and then a half a time, which gives you 3.5. And so this is connecting us here to the other passages that deal with this time period. It says in verse 26, but the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Again, that's the end of the ruler. Verse 27, then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. Then it says, his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So it's like the kingdom is given to the people, but then it says everybody is going to serve him because it's his kingdom. And the way I see that is these guys are getting to rule and reign. They're the subjects, but they're also the blessed of the king. And so it's the saints inheriting the kingdom because their king is Jesus. And so here we have, here in the book of Daniel, we've got the foundation of this last form of human government. Let's turn ahead now to Revelation chapter 13. Turning ahead, if you haven't turned too quickly yet, stop off in Daniel chapter 9, because I did want to answer the question, why is this a revived Rome? Why not just a completely separate government of the last day? A couple of reasons for that. Number one, you're going from the fourth kingdom, which historically is going to be Rome, and all of a sudden that is the same kingdom when Jesus returns and he puts an end to its power. You've got that in Daniel 2 with the legs of iron and then flowing into the feet of iron and clay. You have that in Daniel 7 where you have the ferocious beast, the fourth, that has the 10 horns on it that are the 10 kings of the last day. But really the clincher for me is Daniel 9:26. Daniel 9:26 is in the middle of the prophecy of the 70 weeks, and it's talking about the coming of the Messiah. In verse 26, it says, after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, and that's referring to his execution, his crucifixion on the cross, but not for himself. And notice, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The people of the prince who is to come. The prince is in verse 27. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, the final 70th week of Daniel, the final 7-year period. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. So this is the Antichrist in verse 27. We back up into verse 26. The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The city of Jerusalem is what was destroyed, and it was destroyed by the Romans, and the prince comes from the same people. That ties it together as some form of a revived Roman Empire. Now, that's not the only interpretation, but that's the one that, for me anyway, makes the most sense. It seems to be one of the most popular interpretations, that that final kingdom is a revived Rome, whether it's just geographically or more, I don't know. Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13 says, then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Verse 2, now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And you at least have to admit that this would remind you somewhat of Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel has a dream and he sees the four winds stirring up the great sea, and then these four beasts coming up out of it: lion, bear, leopard, ferocious beast. There's a similarity. You at least got to give me that much. So as we look at Revelation 13, we have got this seven-headed beast now that's coming up out of the sea, and it's got 10 horns on it. Well, this is kind of close to Daniel 7 as well, and it's got 10 crowns upon the 10 horns. Now, I'm going to suggest again that this beast represents the kingdoms of the world, and specifically, this is the final form. This is the final last world empire. Now, the seven heads, I'm going to suggest, and this isn't the only interpretation by any means, but I'm going to suggest that the seven heads possibly refer to the world empires that have ruled. And so we go back before Babylon at this point, and we go back to Egypt, and then Assyria, and then Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then the revived Roman Empire of the last days. In other words, this beast picturing all forms of human government. You got to think about this for a moment. from the focal point of the nation of Israel. When they went down into Egypt, the Egyptians were the ones that made them slaves. When they came out of Egypt into the promised land, it was the Assyrians that took the 10 northern tribes into captivity. Then the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians, took the two southern tribes, and so forth. So this isn't the only interpretation, but it's attractive to me as I take a look at that. So you have this beast that, again, is representing human government, if you will. The seven heads possibly referring to seven world empires. This 10 horns, which refers to the 10 kings or nations that we've been talking about making up the revived Roman Empire. Now, what about the dragon here? We've got at the end of verse 2, the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. As I read through this, I see the beast as not only the final form of world government, but also the king who is ruling over the final form of world government, which again, John titles the Antichrist. Now, it says here that the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Who is the dragon? Well, we can go back to chapter 12. And again, here's a very interesting description in chapter 12, verse 3, where it says, "And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon," check it out, "having seven heads and 10 horns and seven diadems on his heads." Well, that doesn't really tell us who the dragon is, but verse 9 does of chapter 12, where it says, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan." So it's clearly, isn't that the beauty? I mean, not that we can fully understand all this really good, but isn't it neat that there's so much identification that's taking place here? So in verse 2 of chapter 13, the dragon or the devil and Satan is giving the beast his power, his throne, and great authority. So if this is referring to the king, the little horn of Daniel 7, the ruler, the Antichrist of this final form of human government, he's satanically possessed, if you will. I mean, this is the Satan-inspired man who is ruling the world at this time. Now, I believe this is the midpoint of the tribulation here at Revelation chapter 13, and we'll talk about that obviously more when we get there. But this is a time where there's been a war in heaven. Satan is finally completely cast out, and he's down on the earth wreaking havoc. Let's read more. In verse 3 of chapter 13, it says, "And I saw one of his heads," again, the seven-headed beast, "as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast, so they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?'" So this man, let's say, is mortally wounded. What does mortally wounded mean? It means he was killed, right? It's a successful assassination attempt. But then it says his deadly wound was healed, and then everybody worships him and Satan when that takes place. It's like when you look at Satan, when you look at you see a counterfeit all the way through. Jesus died. He rose again from the dead. You see a counterfeit right here of the Antichrist suffering again, what appears to be a deadly blow, and then coming back to life. And it just takes the whole world by storm. And so everybody thinks that he is the greatest. He is it. He is our savior. He is our hero. And so they worship the dragon, who is Satan. And that's what he's wanted from the beginning, isn't it? I want to be like God from the very beginning, Isaiah 14. Verse 5, "And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months, 3.5 years. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them." So that's what we were reading in Daniel 7, wasn't it? Can you see how it goes hand in hand with that? He's going to prevail over the saints. Now, again, who are the saints? Well, I personally believe during this time that the church is gone. I believe the saints refer to God's people, the nation of Israel, but I also believe those that will get saved during the time of the tribulation. those that will become Christians from every different tribe, tongue, and nation during that time. And it says here, authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. That sounds more like a world dictator to me, doesn't it? Like maybe this starts off as a 10-nation confederacy. Maybe it grows into, or at least seeks to try and grow into, the dominant power over the entire world. It says in verse 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here's the patience and the faith of the saints. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. This is like a wolf in sheep's clothing here, right? So this one is commonly referred to as the false prophet, the one who is the associate of the Antichrist. Verse 12, and he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So if you don't worship the Antichrist by worshiping this image of him that was made, you're going to be put to death. Remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that wouldn't bow down to the image that Nebuchadnezzar made. Whoever didn't bow down was to be thrown in the burning fiery furnace. It's the same type of thing here. If you don't throw your allegiance behind him, you will be put to death. That's why it's going to be so hard for a person to become a Christian during the time of the tribulation, because it's almost certain martyrdom. At the very least, it's going to be a really hard time to try and exist. It goes on to say, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. So if you don't have that number, then you can't buy or sell. So how are you going to survive during that time if you become a believer and are not going to take the mark of the beast? It would be a really difficult time to exist then. But that's not our topic now. We'll talk about that and the mark of the beast when we get to Revelation chapter 13. Final passage. Let's go to Revelation chapter 17, because our focus is on this 10-nation confederacy, and it's represented by these 10 horns that are on the beast. In Revelation chapter 17, we come to Babylon the Great. And we have in Revelation 17 and Revelation 18, the fall of Babylon. And as many commentators see it, and it makes sense to me, you have a religious system in chapter 17, and you have a commercial system in chapter 18. When we look at chapter 17, we're talking about a religious system that has influenced the nations of the world since the beginning of the world, and that is going down. And then in chapter 18, you have the destruction of Babylon, which is clearly a commercial enterprise that has influenced and made wealthy the people of the world. In chapter 17, verse 1, it says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. When we talk here about this woman who's a great harlot and kings committing fornication, you have to remember in the Old Testament, when Israel would abandon God and go serve the false gods, it was referred to as adultery in a spiritual sense. They weren't being faithful to their God anymore, just like if a man and woman weren't being faithful to one another in their marriage relationship. And the idea here is that of a harlot who has influenced the nations of the world, the kings, and has influenced them contrary to God. In verse 3, it says, "So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. It's interesting, isn't it? Because we're brought back to that. Now, if in fact this is a representation of world government, a beast with 7 heads and 10 horns, then you have got a woman who is riding the beast, influencing the beast, and you have also a woman here who is upheld by the beast because she is riding the beast. And again, I'm going to suggest that it is a religious system in the last days. Expositor's commentary said, "It may be said that Babylon represents the total culture of the world apart from God. This beast is sitting upon, or this woman is sitting on a scarlet beast." Where's the many waters part? There it is in verse 1. "I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." This is interpreted for us as well at the end of chapter 17, where it says, there it is, verse 15. "Then he said to me, 'The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues.'" So we're talking about the mass of society. If, again, we've got back to what we're talking about here, the 7 heads and 10 horns, you have this woman who is influencing the nations of the world. In verse 4, "The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead, a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." This woman is the great harlot, but she is also the mother of harlots. One commentator wrote, "The Babylonian system has in one way or another given birth to all false religions." You go all the way back to the beginning of that, and that would be Babel. In Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. And you have the beginning of this false religious system. And like this commentator has said, tracing back the religions of the world. You ever think back that for a moment, that you've got so many different religions and everybody thinks they're right? You know, you've got Christianity, you've got Hinduism, you've got Islam, and everybody thinks that their way is the right way. When you look at it from a scriptural point of view, and specifically what we're talking about here, the religions of the world can be traced back to ancient Babel. And so you've got the beginning of this false religious system upon the world that has affected, if we can put it this way, infected the mass of humanity from the very beginning. And so you have got here at the end this false religious system that is going to be judged. Now, what's it going to look like in its final form, the religious system that is going to, that has influenced the nations to this point? But what is it going to look like in its final form? Many believe it's going to be what we are seeing the seedlings of today, the ecumenical movement, where you've got faiths of the world that are dropping their religious essentials for the sake of unity. In other words, we can have prayer meetings together with Buddhists and Muslims, and let's just drop the essentials, and we'll come together as one big, happy, united, faith-based system. You know, Christianity doesn't set real well with that. And people, I think, for right reasons, look against Christianity because we have this attitude that this is the only right way to come to God. And do you realize that that attitude doesn't generate from ourselves? It originates with Jesus. Because Jesus said in John 14:6, "I am the way." the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. The issue of being able to go to heaven, have a relationship with God, is dealing with sin. Sin is what separates us from God. So it doesn't matter if you're a good person or that you're sincere in your faith, whatever that faith might be. The logic behind it is something has to be done with the sin. That sin has to be forgiven somehow. And the only way it can be atoned for is by the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. He died in my place. And so therein is the logic of Christianity. And that's why he is not one of many ways. He is the way. And so this final religion of the last days is, I believe, going to look like that, where you just have these faiths coming together and dropping the essentials of what they believe for the sake of unity. And that's what's going to prevail in the last day. But it will only prevail for a time, because she, and that's what's happening here in chapter 17, is going down as well. Verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Isn't it amazing that persecution against true Christians oftentimes comes at the hands of religious people? You think about the Pharisees in Jesus' day. I mean, the Pharisees are the ones that delivered Jesus over to be crucified. And so this woman, and I think this is why John is marveling, that she's the persecutor of the church. Verse 7, but the angel said to me, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. And guys, this is going to become like a riddle all of a sudden. And I apologize because our time is really coming to a close. So I'm just going to give you what I got and you can dig into it later, okay? Check it out. Verse 8, the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Everybody get that? It gets better. Verse 9. Here is the mind which has wisdom. Wait a minute. Here's the mind that has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. Now, a lot of people say, well, maybe that's Rome, because Rome was known as the city of 7 hills. But as you move on, it says in verse 10, there are also 7 kings. I think it's the NIV and the NAS that says they are also 7 kings. Remember again that mountains can be figurative for governments, like Jesus, the stone that hit the image and grew into a great mountain. So, there are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the 8th and is of the 7 and is going to perdition. That's something, isn't it? I really think you can break this down, and I actually skipped over one of my slides. But we're back up in verse 8, the beast that you saw, the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit. If the beast is the Antichrist, he is the one that you saw and is not, maybe a reference to his assassination, and yet is coming back to life and yet coming out of the pit. And that being again where the dragon gives him his power, his throne, and great authority. When you get down to here, the beast, verse 11, that was and is not, is himself also the 8th and is of the 7, is going to perdition. Perhaps this is the idea, the 7-headed beast. 5 have fallen. Did we cover that already? Where it said 5 have fallen, 1 is? Yes, in verse 10. There are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. From John's day, the 5 would be those empires: Egypt, Assyria, Babylonia, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. 1 is Rome. 1 has not yet come, a revived Rome. And then the one who is also the 8th, but yet of the 7, the Antichrist in his possessed form, reigning over the world at that time. Again, this isn't the only interpretation of it, but it actually does make sense coming at it from just that base of Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. And we take that as, yes, that really represented Babylon. And then there's going to be another kingdom and a third kingdom of bronze. We take that literally as successive kingdoms that are coming. And as we come down into this final form of this 10-horned beast that's there being 10 kings, again, I think the best way is to try and take it from a literal fashion. Verse 13, these are of one mind. Sorry, verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. So again, if we go back to Daniel 7 and you've got this beast with the 10 horns and the little horn coming up and subduing three, you have got these others that are giving their allegiance, their authority to this ruler who's coming to power, and maybe three who didn't want to, and they were taken out of the way as he comes up so that he does have the authority over this kingdom to rule. Verse 14, these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. That's hard to believe that they would fight against Jesus, but that's what they're going to do. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. So if, in fact, the harlot represents the religious system of the last days, there's coming a point where the beast is going to wipe out this religious system of the last day. Even though this is a compromised religious system, there's coming a point, and it actually makes sense, doesn't it? If it's this point of the midway of the tribulation, where the Antichrist enters into the temple, puts an end to the sacrificial system for the Jews, and then proclaims himself to be God. And again, if you don't fall down and worship him, if you don't worship his image, you're going to be put to death. There's really no room for any kind of ecumenical system, is there? It's like everybody has to worship him or you're put to death. And so this, again, is believed that the religious system goes down at the midpoint of the tribulation, and the commercial system in chapter 18 would go down at the end. Verse 17, for God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind, and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Could the idea there be that this woman who is reigning over the kings had its origin in Babel? Again, Babel that has brought forth, sprung forth all of the false religious systems that have ever been and have affected the entire world, reigning over the kings of the earth. Interesting to see that. So, closing it up here, the 10 horns with the 10 toes of Daniel chapter 2, with the Daniel 7 passage and Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 passage, seems to be speaking to this end of this final form of human government. And that was the topic tonight that we're looking at. It's kind of missed the forest sometimes because of the trees. But the final form of human government that the Antichrist will reign over and ultimately will be brought to its end, which we'll see as time progresses. Okay, let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll open it up, all right? Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for the time just to be going through these passages and talking about what your word has to say concerning the time of the end. And I do pray, Father, that you'll help us to have a clear understanding, as clear as we can at that, of what is yet to come. And thank you, Lord, that you have made a way. Even though this world has been plagued with false religion from the very get-go, it seems, we thank you that you've made it really clear what the right path is, that you've made it really clear in your word, and that you've given so much evidence that your word rests upon. Lord, we thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.